Okay, good evening and welcome to Term 5, Session 3 of the McGillis Esther Shear. And last time we got to the ninth perek, which is the ninth chapter, and we got to Pasuk Yud-Dalet, which is the 14th verse. And tonight we're going to start from verse 15, which is Pasuk Tes Vav. And that's obviously going to be very much carrying on. It's very much in the middle of an idea that we left off with last time. But before I go into the 15th verse, I would like to start off by going through the beginning of the end of Medrash Esther Rabbah, which is the Medrash Rabbah on Megillas Esther. And that you'll find in Esther Parsha Yud, which is Esther section 10. And it is Ois Tes Vav. It's point 15. So again, Medrash Esther Rabbah 10:15. And this is the final section of the Medrash on Megillas Esther. It basically stops pretty much on these psukim, which is where we're at now. It doesn't really continue all the way to the end. So this is pretty much the end of the Medrash Rabbah on Megillas Esther. And it talks there on that point about the magnitude of the miracle of Purim. And that's very important for us because that's what we're going to discuss tonight. Essentially, if you want tonight's shiur in a nutshell, it's that the Jews didn't understand the magnitude of the miracle because they didn't understand what was actually going on. And we'll have to discuss that at quite some length, which is why Mordechai felt the right thing to do be to make a yontif. That's essentially tonight's shiur in a nutshell. If you want the shiur in a nutshell, that's it. Says the Medrash Esther Rabbah. It's written in Tehillim 66:3. Say unto God, Imru le'elokim, Manoira ma'asecha, how awesome are your works. What does that mean? This means how frighteningly awe-inspiring are your wonders. And it's specifically referring to Purim. The Medrash Esther Rabbah is darshaning this pasuk as if it was written specifically for Purim. What does it mean? It means one who witnessed all the facets of Purim should be moved into thankful proclamation of God's salvation. It's normal, if you know what's going on Purim, to bless Hashem. Says the Medrash, for those slated to be killed, they slew their murderers, the ones that would be murderers. So whoever was going to kill them, they killed. And those sentenced for hanging, hanged their executioners. And those subject to drowning at sea, drowned those who had been planning to drown them. Now, obviously, Paro in Egypt decreed that all the males born to Hebrew women be cast in the Nile. But when Paro pursued Klal Yisrael, after they'd been taken out of Egypt by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his entire army was washed away in the Sea of Reeds. So that's another turnabout situation. That's what it says, that your abundant power, your enemies will lie to you. That's an interesting concept. That's carrying on in Tehillim. So the Medrash carries on and it gives a whole list of the most amazing midas of Hashem, the most amazing midas characteristics, the behavioral characteristics of Hashem, in how he does good and organizes people and helps them out one after the other. And essentially, the Medrash Esther Rabbah goes through like over a page of just praising Hashem in how he's always helping people out and how he goes lifnei mishuras hadin, he goes beyond the letter of the law with them, and then he concludes. That's the end of Medrash Esther Rabbah, essentially at this point that we've got to in the Megillah. That's an interesting idea. So we see from here that what the Medrash is talking about now is essentially the magnitude of God's awesome miracle happening in Purim. But frankly, to be honest, as we'll see, most people didn't really think anything really major was actually occurring, especially out in the far-off provinces, as we'll discuss. And if it wasn't for Mordechai promulgating what was going on through the writing of the Megillah, this would have been a blip in Jewish history that had been very quickly forgotten. an absolutely forgotten blip. It just wouldn't mean anything. It was completely unknown about for the majority of people. They didn't really understand what was going on. They had letters, you know, as we're going to discuss. They didn't really understand the depth and the gravitas of any of it. And they really didn't see as if there was any salvation, because they didn't see there was any threat. So the only reason we know there's a threat is because Mordechai is explaining it to us all. So with that in mind, we have to understand why the minhagim, the customs of Purim, were set the way they were. So let's have a look. Let's do verse 15. Again, this harps onto what we did last week. Verse 15. So the Jews who were in Shushan assembled also, gum. What's the also? On the 14th day of the month of Adar. And they killed 300 men in Shushan, but they did not lay their hands on their spoils. We did touch upon the idea of why they didn't lay their hands on their spoils last week. But the Jews were in Shushan assembled. This proves that on the 13th day of Adar, Yud Gimel Adar, rather than the 14th, the law was enacted by Ahasuerus, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Now this exceeds Esther's request that we talked about last time, which seemed very bizarre, that the killing should continue for an extra 24 hours. Esther asked for Haman's sons to be hanged only on the next day. Also, she never asked for a law to be enacted about it. It was more that, could you just do this for me? But the king did her an extra favour, so the people would fear the Jews immediately and gave them very little time to recover from the shock of the king's actions before the battle on the next day. We learnt this was absolutely key because Ahasuerus knew that he wanted the people to take him seriously about his view regarding the Jews, which is now very philo-Semitic, ostensibly. And they didn't understand that because the original decree seemed still in force with them, according to the laws of Persian media. And clearly this was leading to a lot of discrepancy as to whether or not we should or should not obey the first or the second law. When the king is making brand new laws, which are new enactments, that you have to do this, it's very, very clear what it is the king wants in this particular case. Now, the king had another reason for enacting the law and hanging Haman's sons on the 13th, on Yud Gimel. The Jews were still worried to continue the killing on the following day, because they thought maybe somehow the king favoured us and we were allowed to kill our enemies for one day. That's enough. We should be lucky that we got away with that. But maybe Ahasuerus doesn't want us to continue tomorrow, despite saying that he does. And he might change his attitude if we go on killing everybody, and his wrath might turn against us. So we don't want to rattle the cage, as it were, and get into more trouble. Yes, he's given us grace for 24 hours. Now it seems 48. We're only too happy with 24 hours. You know what I mean? But God placed in the king's heart a desire to enact the law in Shushan and hang Haman's sons immediately on the 13th of Adar. So now the Jews don't need to fear that the king is changing his mind. And they're going to say, the king didn't hang Haman's son today for nothing. He must have endorsed it. And in effect, he's ordering us to continue it. He's like showing us the way. Kill Haman's sons, they're bad people. Let's go and kill him, we'll carry on for the second day. And Ahasuerus felt without him doing that, he would lead to this dichotomy where nothing would really happen on the second day, even though Esther's requested it. So he enforced it with the king of Haman's sons early to make sure that the populace knew exactly how he felt about the matter and they shouldn't refrain from continuing their murder spree for another day, which is what Esther told him, in order to be able to keep his throne, to avert a revolution, some kind of revolt or coup, which is what we discussed at the end of last week. So that's important. So the Jews were reassured. And that's what it says. The Jews were reassured and they assembled also on the 14th day of the month, which is Adar. What's the gum? What's the also? You might think that taking revenge day after day is exhausting, and that would weaken them. But because the king had hanged Haman's sons immediately on the 13th, the Jews also, gam b'yom arba asa, They also assembled on day 14, in addition to day 13. And that's the meaning of the additional word gam in this pasuk, the word also in this verse. The Jews were further encouraged when they saw that the king was helping them. They said, you know what, they're going to take up arms on the 14th as well. And that's why it says, Asher b'shushan gam b'yom arba asal l'chodesh adar. That's the gam. They weren't sure what to do about day 14. But when Haman's sons were hanged, okay, that's a green light from the palace. Let's go. So there was 2 days. Interesting that was going on like that. Let's look at Tes Zayin, which is verse 16. U'sha'ar ha'yehudim asher b'medinos ha'melech. And the rest of the Jews throughout the provinces of the king assembled and defended their lives. This is outside of Shushan. And they gained respite from their enemies. Listen to this. And they killed 75,000 of their adversaries. 75,000 people killed on one day. That's big numbers on any war, I think. I don't know, even World War II. I don't know, it's a lot of people to die in one day. But they didn't lay their hands on the spoils. This is all, remember, scattered throughout the provinces, added up to 75,000. Now, we've talked about the events that were happening in Shushan, and that's verse 15. And in verse 16, it tells us throughout the whole kingdom, the Jews did a lot more than they did in Shushan. Because in the provinces, an explicit order to destroy the Jews had not been issued at all. It was only to be prepared on that day. Right? Just be ready. Now that the decree had been reversed and the original edict was clarified to them that the Jews should be ready to avenge themselves on their enemies, some Jews were questioning whether to even attack adversaries who hadn't harmed them, or whether merely just to defend their lives against those who are actively raising up against them. Something we discussed again at length last week. What am I going to do? Should I just go and attack anyone that was giving me hassle? Or should I only just defend myself against an open attack? That was a discussion last week. But the doubts arose because they realized that the message in the letters sent to the ministers contradicted the public proclamation. This is what we discussed again. It's a dichotomy. What is the law? What are we meant to do? But the public extract said that the Jews should avenge themselves against their enemies, which included enemies who did not attack Israel. And that really was unclear that they should be doing that. So because there was an inconsistency, some Jews feared that the goyim would attack the Jews, saying, we're weaker than the Persian army, and the ministers and the viceroys would certainly participate in such an act, claiming that their letters from the king indicated that Ahasuerus himself did not object to Israel's enemies raising up against the Jews, even though the Jews were allowed to defend themselves. So I don't mind you kidding the Jews, it's just the Jews can defend themselves, which is a new thing. Rather than the Jews can actively go and massacre anyone they want. So the Jews refrained from an outright attack on their enemies until they determined whether their adversaries feared them or not. This was key. Were the goyim scared of them? Again, we discussed that last week. They're waiting to see whether the goyim are cowering in their homes, whether the goyim are coming out to kill them. If the goyim are coming out to kill them, that means the first letter is active and we need to just only defend ourselves from those who are going to kill us. But if the goyim are scared of us, that means we've got a green light from God and Ahasuerus to go and seek revenge on anyone we want, which is fantastic. That's exactly what they were waiting for. So what did they do? If the Gentiles were brave enough to come and initiate an attack, they'd only defend themselves. That was psak. That's how the Jews gave their reasoning in that time. But if they were scared of the Jews, then it was a sign they could go and destroy their enemies. Okay? That was how they wanted to look at that as a litmus test to see how they're going to behave. And that's what happened. That's the meaning of the verse, the rest of the Jews assembled. First, Klal Yisrael assembled in unity and defended their lives. But subsequently, they saw that they gained respite from their enemies and their enemies didn't raise up and attack them. Therefore, they felt as if God is giving them the green light to go ahead. So the Jews rode up. They came up. They said, fine, we're going to enthusiastically kill everybody that's been a problem for us. And note that the verse speaks first about enemies and then adversaries. We discussed that at length. What's the difference in an enemy who keeps the issue in their heart while an adversary actually physically manifests that. Most nations are enemies who hate the Jews. That most people hate the Jews in their hearts. But they don't act upon it. Edom and Amalek, for example, are adversaries, and their nature is to bring their hatred into the open and actively attack the Jews. That's an adversary. That's the difference between a Seiner and an Oyev, between an enemy and an adversary. An adversary is proactive. An enemy is passive. They hate you, but that, you know, they're just, they're not out for your good. We did discuss that again last week as well. Let's go into Yud Zayin. This is where things really start changing gear here. B'yom shlosha asa l'chodesh adar v'noyach ba'arba asa. Now, what's going on there? What's noach? Noach is respite, loshen menucha, rest, right? There's some kind of break. It was on the 13th day of the month of Adar that they gained respite. On the 14th, making it a day of feasting and happiness. Now, there is so much to say about this on the 13th, on the 14th. Really, on the 14th, we're talking about only in that year. Only in that year did they feel as if there's anything making a party about. We'll talk about what's going on here. There's a lot of undercurrent as to what's going on with the people and Mordechai and how they feel about it and how he feels about it. There's a difference between the 13th and the 14th. We didn't see the Jews of the provinces, that's outside of Shushan, make the 13th of Adar the day of feasting and happiness. Why not? Wasn't it on the 13th that their death decree had been transformed into life? And now they can go and slaughter 75,000 people. Why didn't they make a party on the 13th? Now it says, the verse says, they gained respite on the 14th, making it, the 14th, a day of feasting and happiness. Why is the Pasuk throwing in the phrase on the 14th between the bits that say they gained respite and making it a day of feasting and happiness? It should have said they gained respite and made a day of feasting and happiness on the 14th day. That would be much better. Also, what does respite even mean here? If it's referring to respite from work, then that's not what we said early in the Gemara about the concept of withholding from malacha for the yontif. That's something we're going to need to discuss. So we'll get to that. We've got to now cut into this concept of where yontif comes in here. Let's start building the scene. We're going to have to do a few psukim, then go through like 6-7 psukim in a go to understand what's going on. On the 13th day of Adar, the Jews were not relaxed because they were scared and they were worried that it was going to be a day where they're going to have to fight for their lives. They weren't sure what was happening. The idea that the 13th was a bad day is actually supported by Rabbeinu Tam. And he says the 13th day of Adar was a general fast day and a day of sorrow and introspection for the community at large. Even when the Jews decided to kill their adversaries on the 13th, they were still scared, saying who knows whether the relatives of those people who we've killed, brothers, sons, whatever, family members, in-laws, will now rampage against us in vengeance, and the first thing in the morning, we're going to have another war on our hands. So on the 14th of Adar, the Jews waited to see what the Gentiles would do. But they discerned that the fear of the Jews had fallen upon the Goyim, and they realized that God had freed them from their enemies, and only on the 14th could they actually rejoice, because that true respite made it a day of feasting and happiness, so they could really only be happy on the 14th. While they were raising up on the 13th, they had no idea whether or not they were going to do was going to last, and even incite further violence. When all the Goyim were cowered in terror because HaKadosh Baruch Hu put them in that situation on the 14th, only then could the Jews actually let go and actually rejoice. That's why only the day of the 14th was set as Purim and not the day of the 13th, which is really where the turnabout actually occurred. It's an interesting question, that. Why do we set it on that day? Because really, the actual turnabout happened on the 13th. Yeah, but we weren't clear what was happening on the 13th. We needed to get to the day of the 14th to see that everyone was scared of us, to know it was all from God to start with. verse 18. But the Jews who were in Shushan assembled on the 13th and on the 14th, gaining respite on the 15th, making it, the 15th, a day of feasting and happiness. So in Shushan, everything took an extra 24 hours. On the 15th of Adar, the Jews of Shushan tried to achieve what the Jews in the provinces had achieved on the 14th. And they gained respite only on the 15th. So they made the 15th day of Adar a day of feasting and happiness, known as Shushan Purim, but not on the 14th, because they were still in great danger of losing their lives on the 14th. Verse 19. Therefore, the Jewish villagers who live in unwalled towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of happiness and feasting, a festival, and a day for people to send food portions to their fellow. But notice the Jews in Shushan didn't. The Jews in Shushan didn't do that. Now, we have to ask about the significance of these aspects of celebration, which is essentially the specific minhagim that we have about Purim, the special customs that we have to celebrate the festival of Purim. Also, why did Mordechai alter the items on the list? Instead of festival, he wrote gifts to the poor. Because it says in verse 22, if you compare this with verse 22, to make them days of feasting and happiness for a man to send food portions to his fellow and gifts to the poor. So you should also see verse 8, 17 as well, where we discuss this. And you should also see verse 22 here. So clearly things are changing in what Mordechai wants to do. Let's have a look at it. Don't forget what we learnt in the second, third and fourth prokim. It's all one idea. God saved us by turning evil into good. And therefore, we have now got established four separate customs. Now, remember we discussed on Gemara Megillah, Daf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, 12a, why God even ordained the Jews deserve destruction. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he maintained that they deserved death because they bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol in the times of Daniel. However, according to the Medrash Esther Rabbah, and that was Parsha Zayin, that's section 7.18, it was actually because they'd taken part of the feast. And that besides the feast, the Jews were spiritually defiled by having been forced to gaze at these prostitutes that were paraded in front of them. And both of the transgressions, both of them bowing down to the idol and indulging in the feast, combined to make the Jews now deserving of this sentence. Some say it was really the sentence of bowing down to the idol in time of Nebuchadnezzar, which was in abeyance, and Purim triggered the problem rather than a combined. But okay. Now, even were only one of these sins the real cause for the trouble, the Jews wanted to rectify, make a tikkun for both of them and make Hashem happy again. So they said like this: idol worshippers are punished by death. That's the din in the Torah. And if we bow down to an idol, we should appear as if we are dead. Because anyone afflicted by Haman's decree is as if he's already dead. And to symbolize death, they said, let's mourn for ourselves. They don sackcloth to make a hesped for their own selves. They literally wailed for their own death of their generation. And that's why the verse said in 4:3, in every province, there was a great mourning for the Jews with fasting, weeping and wailing. What great mourning? Themselves! They sat mourning for themselves. Ah, oh, it's like they're dead. Ah, oh, that's the din of Avodah Zarah being put out right there. If you want them dead, they're dead already. They're making their hesped right there for themselves. It's like they're attaining their own personal Avodah. So the din of Nebuchadnezzar is done with. They also said, if we're guilty of indulging in the feast, there are two aspects. One is we ate forbidden food and drink. So to counter that, let's fast, which is why verse 4:3 says with fasting. And if we deserve punishment because of our sinful gazes, Let those eyes which enjoyed those gazes shed tears. So that's why it says in 4:3, with fasting against the food, weeping against what the eyes looked at, and wailing at their own hesped, as if they'd had for avoid a Zara. So the Jews themselves were only too happy to follow Mordechai's advice in doing this, because they feel as if they knock two birds with one stone, as it were. They knock out the sin of Nebuchadnezzar, and they knock out the sin of the Mishdei. Now, both of these averas, the bowing to the idol and the feast, were committed in public. It's a very important nafka minute as to what's going on here. It's a practical difference. Doing a sin like that in public is much worse than doing it in private. Not to say it's okay to do it in private either, but it amplifies the mitzvah, the avera, I'm sorry, to do it in public. Now, there's a problem with that. Apart from the chilul Hashem, that it looks like Jews bowing down to an idol, there's another mitzvah which is missing here. Every Jew sinned in front of his fellow Jew, right? Bowing down to the idol, going to the Jews of Shushan, 18,000 men, went to that party. In addition to each Jew's personal sin, there was another transgression. Every Jew witnessed his fellow doing an Avera, but he didn't try to stop him. We have a mitzvah of Teichacha, admonition. It is not okay, and it is not a Torah thought to say, let people do what they want to do in the privacy of their own home. Behind closed doors is none of my business. That's not true. That's simply not true. Says Rabbi Zev Lef. Rabbi Zev Lef, Shlita, says as follows. Let's say there's a law that nobody can squirt CFC-containing gas canisters, like deodorant or something, because chlorofluorocarbons are very, very bad for the ozone, and they can destroy the Earth's atmosphere, causing the whole world to heat up, causing untold problems for the entire world. Now, let's say a guy decides to shut himself into a room and squirt 50 cans of CFC because he likes the smell. And he'll say, none of your business. It's behind closed doors. It's none of your business. I can do what I want. Now, the answer is that's not true. The effects of what he's doing will go into the atmosphere, and that effect will accumulatively add into the global greenhouse gas problem. And he himself is destroying ozone layer and assisting the warming up of the earth. That affects every single human being on earth. So even though what he's doing is completely private, and he says, none of your business, it's behind closed doors, you know, I'm not in public. A Jew has an obligation to say, no, you're doing an avera in private. You can't do that because it's affecting all world Jewry. It's affecting the spiritual barometer of the world, let alone in public. If a Jew's doing something wrong in public, it is behooving of the Jews that see that to reproach that individual and say, you know, we're not allowed to do that. And if he says, I don't care, you have to stop him. You have to push and stop him. You can't let that happen. That's bad news. Now, today, you know, we're scared of reproving an individual because we think not only will they not stop, but they'll even ridicule the Torah and those that uphold it. But if you know that you can have any kind of influence on someone and say, listen, you're really not allowed to do it. I know you want to do the right thing. That's not okay. You have to do that. You have to do that. So now what did the Jews do? They all saw each other bowing down to the idol, and they all saw each other sinning at the feast, and nobody said anything, which means they're over another avera. They've missed the opportunity, sorry, the mitzvah of doing the mitzvah of reproach and reproval. And saying, you know, you're not allowed. Only Mordechai was running around the street saying, don't go. Don't go to this. This is horrendous. Well, while people were there, they weren't saying, let's all leave. No, it's terrible. They're beating each other up. You're not allowed to eat that. You can't drink that. So even if there were some individuals who didn't sin themselves, they just stood at the back of the party. They didn't partake of any food. They didn't partake of any drink. And they were careful where they looked. They still sinned by being presents. In them just having their presence there, seeing their brethren do this and not stop them. That's already considered a sin. You know, all Klal Yisrael was punished for the sin of the Chet of the Egel, the sin of the golden calf. But very few were actually involved in reveling with the golden calf. The rest of Klal Yisrael were reproved by God for not being proactive to stop those reveling from doing it. You should have got in there and prevented them from doing that to start with. Like, oh, well, you know, that's that crew. That's that group. That's the dancing around the golden calf crew. We're not You know, I'm not part of that. I would never do that. So go and stop the ones that are doing. No, it's not for me to stop them. What do you mean? It's not for you to stop them. Yes, it is. You're a Jew. You've got collective responsibility. You've got to do what you can do. That's a sin in and of itself. A lack of action preventing your brethren from sinning. And that is on your account, not their account, your account. Because you didn't do anything. They knew this was a problem as well. So apart from bowing down to the idol and apart from attending the feast, they've now got the problem of indifference to each other's plight. And that's another sin in heaven's books. So that means that the gathering of the people, where each Jew came to eulogize all the other Jews. I'm eulogizing you, you eulogize me. So like, you know, we're both like as if we have the din of being dead because we were bound down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. And I'll now tell you how terrible that was. And you tell me how terrible that was with weeping and wailing. That's a when you give a eulogy, you don't eulogize yourself. You eulogize someone else. So, you know, so I'll eulogize you, eulogize me, and together we'll eulogize each other. That's what it means. By the way, if the famous Gemara of Baba Basra, someone who davened for someone else first gets answered first. One who prays for his fellow as in need of the same thing gets the answer first. That's a Gemara of Baba Kama. Gemara of Baba Kama, Daf Tzadi Beis Amud Aleph, 92a. Right? So we know that you always daven for someone else. So if you eulogize, you're doing it for someone else. So too, if I do something for you now, well, I eulogize you and you eulogize me and we're working together doing it for each other, that will counter the sin of inaction regarding the reproach that was required. And eulogies, by the way, are always public by nature. No one goes into a room, shuts a door and then eulogizes someone. A eulogy is always made, a hesped is always made in public. So this atones for the public nature of the sins as well, both the idol and the party. That's why in 4:16, chapter 4, verse 16, Esther commanded, go, assemble the Jews. That's what she said to Mordecai. What was her intention? To publicly rectify the sin that had been committed in public. Israel's tshuva took the form of a eulogy because each individual was distressed over everybody else. And therefore, everyone will be answered because one who prays for his fellow and is in need of the same thing is answered first. So if we're all in need of redemption because of Haman, and I'm davening for you, and you're davening for me, we both get answered first, we both get off the hook because we're davening for each other. So she was leveraging that spiritual truth. She was leveraging that metaphysical reality and saying, look, we know this works. Go out there in public and daven for each other. Eulogize each other, you'll knock all the Averas out. So to completely return to God and do a tshuva shlema, which was the key of the salvation of Purim, triggered by Mordechai and Esther, the Jews had to display subjugation through four methods. Number one, mourning. Public mourning for each other, not for themselves, for each other, which knocks out two issues. One is the idol, death. Two is, because I'm mourning you and you're mourning me, it takes away the public nature of these Averas because we're doing a public mitzvah. Fasting atones for the eating and drinking at the party. Weeping and wailing, that is eulogy, also knocks out the weeping is the eyes that stared at incorrect things at the party. And the wailing is the eulogy which knocks out the Avodah Zarah. All that together can knock out both Nebuchadnezzar's idol and the feast and the lack of admonition, all in one action. All in one action. Brilliant, brilliant initiative. Very clever plan that was obviously very aware of the problem at hand. Now, after God saved the Jews, the Rabbonim established four customs at Mordechai's behest. And they correspond to the four types of sadness Klal Yisrael were experiencing. Now, what was this? They instituted, number one, a festival replaces mourning. The exact opposite of mourning is a yontif. The exact opposite of a yontif is mourning. Feasting is the exact opposite of fasting. So to counter the fasting, they made a feast, Mishnah. Happiness replaces weeping. You've got to have Simchas Purim. You've got to be, we do lots of things to be happy on Purim. And sending food portions replaces the wailing that is eulogy. Now, the first three seem extremely logical. I'm perfectly happy to say festival versus mourning, feasting versus fasting, happiness versus weeping. But I don't get how sending mishloach manos, sending food parcels to your friend, is going to counter the wailing of eulogy. How is me sending two food parcels in any way countering me making a hesped over you? We've all been sitting in a ring together, 1,000 people, all eulogizing each other. Oh, you know what's going to be the opposite of that? Send food parcels out. I don't get it. So the first three make sense. The last one, not so clear. So let's talk about the last one. What's going on with Mishloach Manos? Every Jew was mourning over every other Jew's plight. Every Jew was worried for their fellow. They realized everyone else is going to die. So you're worried about him and he's worried about you. And they're crying out that he himself is personally responsible by not protesting against your sin and having caused you your death. Had I've just said something, maybe Kodesh Baruch Hu would have left you off the hook. But now that I didn't, the death penalty's on you. And he's saying the same thing about me. And we're sitting there in a cycle, eulogizing ourselves, feeling bad that we didn't admonish each other. So every Jew wasn't thinking about their own plight. They were thinking about their fellow's plight. That's the key of this tshuva that was necessary, by the way, to undo the problem. So each man sending food portions to his fellow acknowledges his friend's consideration in feeling the pain of his personal distress. It's a form of thanks. I saw you were crying over me the other day. You were really genuinely worried about me. I want to do something. Here, have a chocolate and an apple. I feel bad. I feel bad that I caused you such distress. I saw you weeping over me. So to fulfill the mitzvah of sending Mishloach Manos to your friend, at least two portions, at least, you can have more, but minimum two readily edible foods must be sent to one person. Why two different foods? Just give one packet of food and you fulfill the idea that I wanted to give you something. I saw you in distress. I gave you a bottle of wine. I gave you a bottle of whiskey, a nice bottle of whiskey. I saw you really upset about me. You're really worried about my future. I saw that. It really means something to me. I want to give you something. Here, have something. Why two readily eatable foods? Answer. Each Jew, listen to this, says the Alshach HaKadosh. Each Jew was distressed about the fate of both body and soul of his fellow Jew, which were as if both body and soul were dead because of Haman's decree and the bowing to the idol. Haman wanted to kill your body. He didn't care a hoot about your neshama. Bowing down to an idol has killed your soul. From Shemaim's perspective, it's like a death warrant. So each Jew was worried about the body and the soul of his fellow. So each Jew gets the gift from the person he was worried about in the form of food. What does he get? Two pieces. Why? One symbolizes the body, one is symbolizing of the soul. I saw you were upset for both elements of me, both body and soul, guf and nefesh. I saw that. And therefore, I want to give you two bits of food to say thank you for being worried about both bits of my existence. And that's why Mishloach Manos is set with two separate items of food. That's a worth coming moment. Now you know that. That's why there's two bits of food in each Mishloach Manos parcel. Now, mourning, fasting, weeping, and eulogy were indeed replaced with happiness, feasting, festival, and sending delicacies. And now we know why we send Mishloach Manos, and why we feast against the fast, and why we have to be happy against the mourning. But what is going on with Matanos Le'evyonim? Sending gifts specifically to the poor, be it money or food. That's complicated. So let's discuss this. So we've done the Mishteh. The Mishteh, you got a feast because you were fasting. You've done Kriyas Megillah. That knocks out also the concept of the Avodah Zarah. We discussed that way back when, that we've made a public Kiddush Hashem by reciting the Megillah. We know that we have to give two parcels of food. But what about the gift to the poor that was enacted? What's going on there? So it's a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Hay Omad Beis, that's 5b. And it says that although Purim is a festival, the Jews do not refrain from malocha, which are the externally creative activities which we refrain from on Shabbos and Yom Tov. And they don't refrain from that on, the Jews do not refrain from that on Purim. Now, in verse 19, it said, the Jewish villagers who live in unwalled towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of happiness and a festival. That is specifically referring to a voluntary acceptance rather than any obligatory undertaking, says the Gemara. That's a very interesting statement. They voluntarily accepted upon themselves to do this as they saw fit, as it were, at that particular time. Now, Mordechai wasn't happy with that. He wants this to be formal, because he feels as if, unless you publicize the miracle here, you wouldn't realize the miracle happened at all. So Mordechai actually wrote orders to all Jews in the world. You should see later, Psukim Chof Beis, that's 22. Yeah, even Chof through Chof Beis, or 20, 21, 22, where he enacted certain mitzvahs. And the effect was that they should accept Purim as a proper festival. But he saw, like a Yom Tov, but he saw the Jews were simply unwilling to refrain from working on Purim. They had to do malacha. They couldn't stop kindling fires and carrying an object from one domain type to another. So they were not going to keep it like Shabbos, like Yom Tov. So what did he do? He worked out a plan where even without formal commitment, the Jews would still be abstaining from work on Purim. He wanted to make it as Yom Tov-like in lieu of the fact that the Jews weren't going to accept it as a Yom Tov. So this is really interesting. He realized that the biggest hurdle to the Jews not accepting that they're going to refrain from work was actually the poor. He said it's the poor that is, they're the problem. The people who are destitute and lack basic daily needs are the ones who wanted to go and work on Purim and do malacha, because they felt as if their lives depend upon it. And it's a big tircha for them to put down their tools on Shabbos and Yom Tov, but they'll do that because that's all the way from the Torah kind of thing. But regarding today, I don't need another day where I can't work either. So what did he do? He said, what's the reason why you don't want to work? The reason is, you don't think you've got enough food or enough money to get by on that day, so you want to go to work. So what did he do? He made an obligatory mitzvah where Jews have to give gifts, dafka, to the poor and the destitute. And so the poor themselves don't need to worry about food on that day, because there's a mitzvah that the wealthy are going to enable them to eat and drink the Mishteh, the Feast of Purim, which they wouldn't be able to afford otherwise. So it has to be given to them. In which case, why do you need to go to work? It's going to be laid on for you. I'm going to make a mitzvah to make anyone that can afford it give you a full feast. How about that? Yeah. Well, that changes things. Yeah. So you're willing maybe to put your work tools down today? Well, yeah, if you're going to give me a slap-up meal and I don't need to worry about it, and that's going to be enacted for all Klal Yisrael, then yeah, I don't see why not. Now, this is the subject of quite a halachic tumult as to what Mordechai was actually doing. What was the mitzvah? So Rabbi Eliezer of Worms, known as the Rekeach, he talks about what's going on here in the Megillah on this Pasuk. And he says there's two reasons for the mitzvah of Matanos Le'evyonim on Purim, the mitzvah of giving gifts, monetary or food, to the poor. Here's the first reason. Reason number one, says the Rekayach. The poor people will be able to rejoice and enjoy a festive feast of the Mishte that Mordechai is enacting, because they'll have the means to do so, or the food to do so, because it'll be given to them. That's mitzvah number one, as it were. That's rationale. Rationale number one. Now think about this. The reason the Rekayach is giving here is not tzedakah, but rather a facilitator for Simchas Purim, for the joy of Purim, specifically through Mishte. Let's get this really clear. It's not charity that you're giving. It's a facilitation for those that can't to nonetheless revel on Purim. That's rationale Aleph. Rationale base is actually that act of giving Matanas Yevyonim is a charitable act towards the needy, and it's always a schus, a merit, to give alms to the poor. And why should we do that? Because God himself showed charitability towards us by saving us from the plight of Haman. And therefore we do a tzedakah as a reciprocal act to Hashem's tzedakah of saving us. So rationale number two is that Mordechai is enacting a mitzvah of tzedakah to show gratitude to God for doing tzedakah to us. Rationale two. Now, according to the first rationale, that it's only a facilitator to allow poor people to be able to enjoy the Mishne, it has no connection to the mitzvah of tzedakah at all, which, by the way, is a year-round obligation. But according to the second reason, Matanas Le'Evyonim is merely part of the general obligation of tzedakah, of charity, anyway. It's like an enhanced special daily charity. The only difference is between that and a regular tzedakah. I know, a guy walks around in shul with a pushka and you put money in the pushka. It's no difference in Matanas Le'Evyonim, according to this. The only difference is, according to the second rationale, is that that particular tzedakah can only be fulfilled during the daytime of Purim and it cannot be postponed to any other day. So according to the second rationale, Mordechai is making a special dose of tzedakah, doubly rewardable. One is rewardable because God says you've got to give charity. And two is because a tzaddik, one of the Rabbonim, one of the members of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, Mordechai was one of the men of the Great Assembly and a Sanhedrin member. And he has said, there's a special new mitzvah of tzedakah on this day to give tzedakah as an additional schus, and you only get that bumper mitzvah if you give it on Purim day. All of that is only according to rationale base. It's got nothing to do with rationale Aleph, of just facilitating the poor to be able to keep the Mishne, which is another element of Purim. In fact, if it's rationale Aleph, it might not even really be a regular tzedakah at all. It's like, I've got to pay people to keep Purim that can't afford it. Now, I don't have a final ruling as to whether it's like the Rekayach's version Aleph or Base. There is a very in-depth discussion in this with Rambam in Hilchas Megillah, in the 17th chapter of the Laws of Megillah. And you'll see the Chofetz Chaim in the Bir Halacha on Shulchan Aruch, Sof Reish Tzadi Dalet, which is 694. And you can see the Sifsei Kohen, that's the Shach, on Yoridaya, Reish Nun Ches Chof Hei, that's 258.25. And they all have opinions. Is it type 1, facilitating Purim? Or is it type 2, a special din of tzedakah, which applies only on that day? I don't know. It's one or t'other, or both. But those are the discussions of what's going on with Matanas Le'Evyonim. So Mordechai was taking into account the poor when he said that people should make Purim on a day of feasting and give to the poor, Amatanas Le'Evyonim. That's in verse 22. And in that way, it seems very clear that he's going, well, if you read it like that, it seems very much like type one, doesn't it? But in that way, both the rich and the poor can fully enjoy Purim in their own home. And the poor will refrain from work, according to that rationale. So okay, we've got the money, in which case we can make it more of a yontif. The whole key here is that either which way, Mordechai wanted to make Purim a yontif. That was absolutely key for him. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to read ahead. Oh, gosh, 9 verses. Let's do verse 20. I'm going to do it as a chunk. So it says in verse 20, and Mordechai wrote down all these things. What? What it is I want you to do. That this is what you've got to do now, how to keep Purim. And sent out letters to all the Jews throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, those near and those that were far, ordering them to observe annually the 14th day of the month of Adar and the 15th day thereof, that's for Shushan Purim, as the days on which the Jews gained respite, i.e. 14 and 15, because outside in the provinces they gained respite on the 14th day, and inside Shushan they only gained respite on the 15th day from their enemies, and the month which had been transformed for them from one of grief to happiness, and from mourning to festival, that they should make them days of feasting and happiness, for each man to send food portions to his fellow and gifts to the poor. So the Jews undertook to continue what they had begun to do. Now, what does that mean? They'd begun to do it in that particular time, but they had no intention of keeping this as any kind of a long-term minhag. This was something specifically for the Jews in those days. It wasn't expected for you and me. No, they're going to take this on as now a universal custom. And what Mordechai had ordered them to do. And I'm going to add, for perpetuity, which is not how the Jews at the time understood it, which is we'll discuss that. They just saw this as a temporary thing from their generation. For Haman, the son of Hamadasa, the Agagite, the adversary. What does adversary mean? Someone who practically manifests their evil against you. Of all the Jews, he was an adversary of every single man, Jewish woman and child. Conspired to annihilate the Jews and cast a pur, that is the lot, to confound them and annihilate them. Why? Because he was waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu's schus to run out on the 13th of Adar, at the end of the Shiva from Zion Adar. And also that they had never been put through a test of a Baal Bechira quite like this. So it was a big concern. But when she came before the king, this is key because the Jews didn't know this, by the way. The Jews in the provinces had no idea what Esther was doing. But when she came before the king, he said, along with writing it in a letter, that his evil scheme, which he conspired against the Jews, should revert back on his own head. And they hanged him and his sons on the gallows. The gallows, definitive article, that's the thorn bush he made into the gallows, specifically for Mordechai. This is why they named these days Purim, literally lots, after the poor, after the lot. Therefore, because all of the words of this letter, which is the Megillah, and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, some say what had reached them, the Jews confirmed and undertook upon themselves and upon their posterity, that's you and me, and upon all those converts who join them, that's a universal law, to observe without fail these 2 days, the 14th or 15th day of Adar, depending upon where you live, as they are written and in their proper time every year. Now that is really interesting. Now why is Mordechai so keen to spell out in black and white, this isn't just for you, this is for everybody, and we're all going to take this on, and we've all got new mitzvahs to keep. This would never have happened if it wasn't for Mordechai's instigation. Haman wrote 2 letters, a secret letter to all the ministers of the provinces outlining the Jews' destruction, and a public, ambiguous notice that people must be, quote unquote, ready on that day. The Jews themselves did not know what this public order was referring to, and they simply didn't realize the danger that they were in. But the Jews feared that they may well have been the subject of this decree. Now, there were 2 reasons. One we discussed last week. One reason is Only Jewish people were instantly recognizable as a people scattered throughout the entire empire. Throughout the empire of 127 provinces, there are peoples everywhere, but they're completely unique to their geographical location. The French are in France. The Germans are in Germany. Yeah? The Jews are Jews wherever they are. There was only one nation, quote unquote, that was still absolutely its own nation, irrelevant of where it was. So they were fearful that this raising up against the people was talking about them. That we discussed last time. But there's another reason. It's like this. They noticed that these public proclamations happened to only appear where Jews resided. This is an interesting medrash. These public notices that Haman sent out to all the only went up on street corners and in the town halls where there was a significant Jewish population and word of that got out. People were saying, we never heard such a thing. That's because no Jews live there. They put two and two together and thought, look, one is we're a people that's uniquely identifiable. Two is it happens to be that all the people need to be ready on that particular day are only being told to do that where there are Jews. There's a noticeable Jewish component living in that area. Like in Saddleworth, in Greater Manchester, there are hardly any Jews living there. So imagine no notice was put up in Saddleworth. Interesting, the notices only went up in Bury and Salford. How interesting. And in London, it only went up in like Barnet and Haringey, you know. It didn't go up, you know, in like, the, you know, the outer suburbs. Why would that be? They added two and two together. One is where people and two is, happens to be where we're living. Maybe we've got something to do with it. So now, their fear was inferred. It wasn't clear. They were scared. They were making an inference. There was no explicit threat. That's what it says. In every province, wherever the king's command and his law reached, there was great mourning for the Jews. That was in 4:3. Doesn't mean it reached everywhere. Now, since the Jews in those places did not fully comprehend the gravity of the situation, they didn't fully appreciate their salvation either. Because they didn't really know the situation they were in. You can't tell me I'm really a guy that's got a terrible diagnosis, right? But no one tells him. The doctors, for whatever reason, they forgot to tell him. And then he gets better a week later. He's like, well, I was feeling bad, but now I'm better. He doesn't realize what happened. The doctors had this terrible diagnosis and he's been saved by a miracle. He doesn't even know that because he wasn't even told how bad the situation was. That was like the Jews in the provinces. They didn't really know what was going on. Yeah, they were worried, but it wasn't like, oh my gosh. It wasn't like they knew what was cooking. Now, there were five separate reasons. Five separate reasons as to why the Jews in the provinces did not perceive the wondrous nature that there was going on. And these five separate reasons we'll do now, then we'll stop. Then we'll do these five again next time because they're the subject of these psukim that we just read. Reason number one. The Jews did not know about the secret letters to the ministers, which detailed their destruction. All they knew that people had to be ready on that day. And they assumed that if they were indeed the subject of the trouble, they'd only be looted. They'll have a go at our property, but not us. They didn't realize it was about their lives. That's number one. In the provinces we're talking, that's number one. Number two, the Jews in the provinces were not aware of Haman's incredibly high rank and how he'd been honored in the palace so extremely, unlike the Jews in Shushan that did. And that the Achashrosh honored him so much that for Haman's sake, he would never undo the decree. The Jews in the provinces didn't understand that. They heard of him, but they didn't know how great he was. Number three, Israel did not know whether the king hated the Jews or whether he really liked the Jews and was only enacting Haman's decree to please Haman. They didn't know whether or not the king's philo-Semitic or anti-Semitic. They can't judge. Remember, this wasn't the day before mass media. They didn't know exactly what was potting like the Jews in Shushan. And they didn't know if the king really wanted the decree or not. Reason number four, the Jews did not realize that it was God who had made the salvation in his mercy. They rather thought they just weren't guilty of sinning against him and Haman had simply just received his just desserts for some other problem. The Jews in the provinces didn't go to the party. They didn't feel as if they'd done anything wrong. You know, the party triggered the sin of Nebuchadnezzar's bow down to the idol. They didn't go to the party. So they felt as if this, wasn't God had saved them from some miraculous event. It was like, whatever, Haman was naughty and he got hanged, whatever. They didn't understand the depth of what was going on, why Haman was being hanged. And finally, these Jews, especially the Jews in the most far off places in the provinces, right to the outskirts of the kingdom, had not heard about Esther risking her life by unlawfully approaching the king before 30 days had passed. I'll tell you what they'd say. King Ahasuerus didn't know his wife was Jewish. But when he found out, he quashed the decree that Haman had made. And of course he's going to do that. And of course he killed Haman. Makes sense. They'd perceive this whole thing as a naturally reasonable outcome of mistaken identity. You know, I'm going to do this thing against Jews because Haman, oh, my wife is Jewish. Oh my gosh, Haman wants to kill my wife. I'll kill Haman and just quash the decree. Yeah, well, that's normal. Now that you find out you're Baruch Hashem, your wife is Jewish, good for us. Of course you're going to do this. You put all five of these together. Number one, they didn't know about the secret letters. Number two, they didn't understand Haman's high rank. Number three, they didn't know whether or not the king really hated Israel or loved Israel. Number four, they didn't realize that God is making a miracle because of the danger they're in. And number five, that Esther risked her life. They didn't know any of this. They realized, Mordechai realized this poshet seems like nothing to them. It's another blip in the pan, another news story. That's why he felt as if he must institute a chag. He's got to be proactive and make this a chag. Because if I don't, the actual miraculous nature of this event will be lost for all time. So he went about instituting special mitzvahs for perpetuity for all Jews, and he even wanted to go as far as to make it a yontif. Because he was concerned that the Jews and the prophets would literally poo-poo this whole thing. So, ach, yeah, we get this the whole time. There's always something going on against the Jews. It's no biggie. No, this was a biggie. This was life and death for every single Jew, and people didn't get it. Only really the Jews in Shushan understood it more deeply, and they were more concerned about it because of it. So now next time, what we've got to do is I'd like to go through these verses that we've just gone through, which were verses 20 through 27, right? 20 through 27. And we've got to address why these five reasons were so key for Mordechai to actually institute the mitzvahs that he did and what they came to counter. Because essentially, if it wasn't for Mordechai and us learning the beginner now, we would not know a thing about this. And it would just be said, as, yeah, there's always problems in Persia. So that's really, really important to get clear. I'd like to thank you very, very much for taking out of your time. And I wish you all a kasiva v'chasima tova. I hope you have a good, happy, healthy year where all your prayers are answered for the good. And I look forward to seeing you in the next year.